Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Nell Irvin Painter, professor emerita at Princeton University, author of 7 books prior to her most recent tome, The History of White People, a work she says might have been entitled Constructions of White Americans from Antiquity to the Present. Nell Irvin Painter will be at Rhodes College on February 18th at 6 p.m. to give an overview of her book, and I'm so pleased to have her with me on Counterpoint today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, how can a book about whiteness and Americanness start in the ancient world when the United States never existed?
Good question. Not only did the United States not exist, the concept of race as a scientific category about people didn't exist. Many people think that you can read the way we think about race back across the millennia, as if the ancient Greeks thought the way we do. So I had to address that misconception to start with and then work up to where ideas of race as science began in the 18th century.
So were the Greek and Romans not white? Did that category not exist for them?
That's correct. The category did not exist. Now, they could see the colors of people. I mean, they could see that some people were lighter skinned and some people were darker skinned. But it didn't hold the kind of meaning that it holds for us. So let me give you an example. A colleague of mine who's an ancient historian told me about how the upper class ancient Greek men, you know, who had their games and they played in the nude and they're very proud of their bodies. And if their sculpture is anything to go on, they had a lot to be proud of. They would laugh at the Persians for being unmanly because the Persians had very light skin because they didn't go outside and they didn't go outside and run around naked. It was clear that Persians looked lighter than Greeks to the Greeks, but it didn't have the same meaning. It meant not going outside and not being manly. In my book, I mention Herodotus noting about the Scythians. The Scythians were people to the north and vaguely to the east, where we would think of Ukraine and Russia. And Herodotus is talking about their habits of life because he thought that people's outward appearance had to do with how they lived. He's explaining that the Scythian men have to prove themselves in war, and they have to kill a man in order to be considered a manly adult males. When they did that, they would take the skin off an arm and make the arm skin into a quiver to put their arrows in. And this was considered very, as Herodotus says, white and showy, because it was different from the regular kind of stuff that Scythians had around them, like animal skins, for instance. So Herodotus notes that the Scythians could see light and dark, but it didn't mean the same.
And in the book, you talk about the way in which the ancient world really emphasizes a lot more where you come from, these Scythian people from the north or Persians. What about the Romans? What were some of the categories? You mentioned civilization and barbarism.
Yeah, that was the big one for the ancient Greeks and for the Romans. You can see it even once race gets into the equation in the late 18th century. There's still a kind of barbarian, civilized manhood mixture. So that the people who prized Germanness, they prized it because it was barbarian and manly, and they contrasted it with the French, who were civilized and therefore suspected of being unmanly.
So now that you're talking a little bit about the modern period, let's transition there. Your book's part of a long line of scholarship that shows that race theory was the dark side of the 18th century, the era known as the Enlightenment. It's really over the course of the 18th century that whiteness was idealized by a series of thinkers who constructed a particular conception of white beauty as science. Tell us a little bit more about how the history of science developed over the 18th century. Maybe you can focus in a little bit on that category that still shows up oftentimes in our racial categories, the notion of the Caucasian. Where did that label Caucasian come from? How is it connected to the history of racial science in the 18th century?
What the difference is depends on whom you ask and when, and how you decide who you ask and when. What do you measure? What do you count? So Blumenbach's fivefold categorization gave us Caucasian, and he looked at skulls. He measured skulls, but he decided to use the word Caucasian for the people in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Northern Africa, Russia as far as the Ob, and into the Indus, into India. So it's a big area. Because the most beautiful skull in his skull collection came from Georgia in the Caucasus. It's a tragic story. This area, the Caucasus, Georgia, Ukraine, from time immemorial was subject to a slave trade. It's a slave trade much older and much longer than the Atlantic slave trade because it fed into the Eastern Mediterranean, the area of wealth.
So let's transition now and talk a little bit about how this ends up coming across the Atlantic into the United States. The 18th and early 19th century is, of course, also the period of the formation of the United States. And you got a chapter that surveys how a slew of different writers begin to pair Americanness with European descent. They're effectively turning America into a white man's country. We can't talk about all of them, but I just want to pick up on a few of these early commentators. There's a tradition that begins with a writer named Crèvecoeur, who sets this whole thing in motion. Tell us a little bit about how he does that, about Thomas Jefferson's ideas about Negroes and their opposite, the Saxons, and then how the African-American intellectual David Walker responds to this discourse in early American history.
So Crèvecoeur was French. And when he talked about the American in his famous equation of the American, this new man, and he talks about mixture, the mixtures, he's talking about French people and German people and English people and Irish people, all Europeans. However, he was including French people. And when he said the American, he meant the American in Canada as well as in the America, which was British North America and soon the United States. That's one of the first formulations that sees a mixture as characteristic of the American and B, mixture only of people from different parts of Europe. You mentioned Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, absolutely fascinating character, an early intellectual, very thoughtful man, and as we know now, a man of his place and his time in terms of his intimate connections. But Jefferson was responding to French concerns about basically the effeminacy, the smallness, the weakness of animals, including people, I think, in the Americas, in the United States. In Notes in the State of Virginia, Jefferson is sitting down in his beautiful, thoughtful Monticello and putting down a very Enlightenment tome. He was contributing to the Enlightenment. And he talks about all sorts of things in his Virginia, including people. Jefferson was a Saxonist in the sense that he was concerned about Saxons and Saxon-ness throughout his intellectual life. He studied Beowulf and ancient Saxons. He got some of his chronology confused. And he believed that Americans, by which he meant white Americans of a better class, were Saxons. And that people in Virginia were not all Saxons. Some of them were Native American Indians whom he admired for their strength and tenacity. And some of them were people of African descent whom he did not admire, whom he employed and did not pay. In a very common turn of thought goes from what the bodies are like, and I don't think he does measurements, but he's very scientific about it. And then he turns to beauty. And that, he phrases it tentatively as if he were only surmising, but he's pretty clear that not only do people like him think that people of African descent are ugly, but also that people of African descent also think of themselves as ugly. Now, mind you, this at a time when he had taken as effectively a second wife, a woman of African descent, and had, what, 3-4 children with her. So beauty becomes one way of judging the races. what was called in the 20th century racial temperament came to the fore. And I think that's what you're talking about in terms of whether people can be civilized, how they act, how they think, and so forth. We can sum that up as racial temperament.
And these things are all sort of beginning to morph together in this period. I mean, we see that running across these different writers. How does someone like David Walker respond to this mixture of ideas about the races?
Although racist thinking became hegemonic, if you will let me use that word, in the 19th and early 20th centuries, it never held complete sway. There were always dissident strands within the intellectual or scientific discourse. David Walker was not a trained scientist, but he was someone who looked around, and he takes on Thomas Jefferson by name. He says that what Jefferson is saying is utterly preposterous. He says, if you look at the history of Saxons or white people, he says, it's full of blood and guts. These people are barbarians. And he uses lots of exclamation points.
You itemize four periods of what you term the enlargement of American whiteness. You note, rather than a single enduring definition of whiteness, we find multiple enlargements occurring against the backdrop of the black-white dichotomy. What do you mean by the phrase, the enlargement of American whiteness? And can you give us an overview of this process in American history?
The first occurred in the Jacksonian era when suffrage was enlarged and tightened at the same time. In the time of the American Revolution, there were large numbers of unfree white people. And suffrage came into American democracy with a limitation according to wealth and a limitation according to gender, of course. So early on, it was propertied white men who could vote. In the Jacksonian era, the property qualifications fell away state by state. The racial categories came in. So you had to be a white male, but you didn't have to have property. This meant that in some states, like Pennsylvania, where propertied black men had been able to vote, those men lost the franchise as poor white men gained it. Included in those poor white men were Irish immigrants. And this makes all the difference in the world in the history of Irish Americans as contrasted with the history of African Americans in the 19th century. African Americans disfranchised, cut off from having a role in American politics, and cut off from patronage jobs like policeman and school teacher. So the first one in the Jacksonian era, the 1830s, is the enlargement of the franchise along racial lines. The second one occurred in the very early 20th century. Let me back up a little bit to explain this. In the middle of the 19th century, large numbers of impoverished Irish people fled Ireland of the famine and came to the United States. They were excruciatingly poor, and they suffered from the injuries of the poor. So they were looked down upon by people like Ralph Waldo Emerson. They were considered Celts, the Celtic race. So in the middle of the 19th century, in Emerson's time, there were different kinds of white people, notably Celts and Saxons. That disappeared early in the 20th century as large numbers of Europeans came from Southern and Eastern Europe, and they were called the Northern Italian race, the Southern Italian race, East European Hebrews, Slavs, Greeks, and so forth. Those were all considered separate races within whiteness. The enlargement brought Irish Americans into a superior race, no longer the Saxon, but the Nordic. So the terminology changed to include Irish Americans in the upper class of races, so to speak. So that's the second one. The third one occurred starting in the 1940s. You see it very much in the 1950s and 60s, when our idea of one big white race became prevalent as a response first to the Nazis, and then as a response to having to deal with black people outside the South. So what had been a dichotomy most useful in the American South spread as poor black people migrated out of the South. So 1940s, 50s, and 60s, one big white race, Greeks, Jews, Polish, Italian, all those people included in that one big white race. That's the third. The fourth is going on now, very complicated, partly by the census categories of both ethnicity and race, by the multiplication of races, some according to political pressures, such as Hawaiian. The Hawaiians wanted a race of their own, and they got it. And by people marrying and reproducing across what were recognized lines of race. So starting with the census of 2000, you could designate yourself as having more than one race. You needed one ethnicity, Hispanic, non-Hispanic, and you could have as many races as you wanted. In 2010, we have a similar breakdown, but it was categorized as black only, white only, black and some other race, and so forth. So very, very complicated. Somebody told me that in the census of 2020, Hispanic will be counted as a race. I only have that as hearsay, so I don't know. But the way the census changed tells us, first, what are the political uses of racial categorization, because that's what the census is for. And second, how we're thinking about race, because it responds to how Americans' thinking changes over time. So now I think we're moving away from whiteness. Partly that's because the laws no longer protect white identity, but also into more of a non-black, in the sense of people escaping the stigma of blackness. So you can be a dark-skinned person, say in my New Jersey, where we have dark-skinned people whose roots are in South Asia, and most of them do not want to be categorized as black. So we have to deal with skin color being disassociated from race. This has always been the case. There have always been very light-skinned black people, some of whom confused people around them by saying, I may look white, but I'm black, and some simply disappearing into categories of whiteness.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Nell Irvin Painter about her most recent book, The History of White People, in anticipation of her visit to Memphis on February 18th. Now, I want to drill a little bit deeper into the post-war American context, because it's in that context that you've indicated that there is this big expansion of whiteness. The language of different kinds of white races begins to drop away. The whole notion of racial science itself has been critiqued in the aftermath of the Nazis and their use of racial science. Let's zero in on what happens in post-war suburban America. So you write, to be American-American had rapidly come to mean being middle class and therefore white. To be the one was automatically to be the other. To get a little bit at how middle class suburbia was in fact a racial project, explain a little bit about how the GI Bill and then loans for housing, and I'm quoting you here, were for white people only. Federal policy made and kept them all white on purpose.
Most people don't know about the use of federal policy in making the suburbs, the post-Second World War suburbs, making them white and keeping them white. Housing is a crucial part of the story of whiteness and blackness in the United States, even for the generation of people born right at the turn of the 21st century and who were growing up in homes that are rented or owned, or in homelessness for that matter.
Let's talk a little bit about what happens in the aftermath of the civil rights movement. Obviously, in Memphis, we have some sense of what that history was about the critique, yes, of racial discrimination and segregation and blight. But tell us a little bit about what happens to the dynamics of whiteness post-civil rights. Give us some sense of where we stand now. You've pointed to this a little bit with some of the craziness in the categories of the census. Give us a fuller picture of how you see some of this playing out today.
To get from the 1960s to where we are now, we need at least 2-3 steps. After the civil rights came Black Power. And Black Power, say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud, gave rise to the movement of white ethnics. Say it loud, and I'm Irish and I'm proud. I'm Italian and I'm proud. I'm not white, I'm Jewish. I'm not white, I'm Greek. So in the 1970s, there was an outpouring of white ethnic chauvinism to match black racial chauvinism. That was the first step. And then we have a gradual kind of breaking down of the barriers between the groups in the later 20th century and into the turn of the 21st century. Early in the 21st century, DNA and mapping of the human genome and a proclamation around 2003-05, around in there, that look, we're all so similar. We're 99.5% the same. Race is not a meaningful scientific category. Let's realize how similar we are, not how different we are. And then about maybe 5 years later, racial lines crept back. There was a piece in the New York Times, I Am a Racial Profiling Doctor. There was heart medicine that was peddled to black people. And so we really backslid from the early 21st century proclamations of let's get over it back to this is the most important category in our country and it's all you need to know about somebody.
And I guess in some senses we can say just in the era of the Obama administration, we've gone from a lot of discourse proclaiming the election of a black president as signifying that we are post-racial to now post-Ferguson and post-Eric Garner. And so this seesawing that you're talking about actually happens over the course of a lot of the 20th century, sometimes with louder voices and sometimes not. But you cover a huge swath of
history. Wait, Jonathan.
Sure.
Let me demur a second. I did my book tour in 2010, a census year. And invariably, after I talked about my book and we started questions and answers, the moderator would start with the first question, which would be, so that means we are in a post-racial era. I got this question all the time. I personally think it is total poppycock. So I would say, this is total poppycock. But then I thought, why should I take this on? So I would say, you know, I'm a Democrat. I would say to my audiences, let's take a vote. How many of you think we're in post-racial era? Show of hands. How many of you think we're not? And not always won overwhelmingly. Nobody ever said we were in a post-racial America.
So I guess that's a significantly minority voice. It seems to get a fair bit of attention. But just to kind of sum up a little bit some of the big lessons that people should take away from the history of white people, it covers a large swath of time. What do you see as some of the key patterns that you've traced and shown over the course of the book that people should take away?
The fundamental point is that things change. There is not one hard, fast answer about what is white race that goes for all time. Things change. And the second one is, which has been very difficult even for people who have read my book, is that ideas about how many white races there are changed. And in earlier centuries, scientists, lay people thought that there was more than one white race. Those are probably the two fundamental lessons. No, the third is nobody ever could agree on what the criteria were and how you decide.
Well, if you'll permit me, I would say there's one other thing. It's not only that the categories themselves have changed and that there's an enormous amount of contingency attached to who gets included in the white category, but the stratification of this. The other thing that you really show is these things are connected to power. It's a question of...
Oh, absolutely.
So you use the term hegemony in the course of this, this notion of who the people are that are the cultural dominant.
Yeah.
Do you want to
say
a little bit more about how power figures into this history?
Yeah, it's tucked into the people who make up the categories, who were virtually, let's see, they're all white and they're all male. So if you're ranking, and ranking is nearly always, not always, but nearly always the first step of taxonomy, that power in terms of whiteness in there, we've talked about beauty, but in there is also wealth and power. So if you want to talk about white people who are not wealthy, you have to use an adjective. You have to say poor white. So wealth is very much a part, and that's part of the reason that the categories are breaking down now, because we have people who are not white who are wealthy and powerful and beautiful. So this is breaking down that nice, neat alignment of racial thinking. I would say also that I've often heard it said that racial tensions have increased during Obama's period in office. And to a certain extent, that's true. But I think it's because for so many Americans, the idea of a black man with that much power is anathema. And they just go crazy thinking about a black president. So it's not Obama himself or anything he would have done. It is the juxtaposition of a black body and the White House.
Nell, thanks so much for helping us to understand that whiteness has a colored past. You didn't use this term, but in the book you really show that it's connected to the history of white supremacy and obviously to racism. There's so much more in the story that you tell that we didn't have time to cover today, but we really look forward to learning more when you come to visit us in Memphis on February 18th at 6 p.m. at Rhodes College. Such a pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.